drive a Chevy, 'cause he drove Chevys. Like him, I'm a baseball fan. I'm going back to see him while he still knows who I am.
Welcome.
Mama says
this is Dr. Steve Nurse. And this is our next series of Is Abled, and it's a series on dementia and Alzheimer's. And what we would like to do here is let you know what you need to know about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The series is 6 episodes, and we will discuss both dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The main person interviewed is Brad Tyson. Dr. Brad Tyson has been a clinical neuropsychologist since 2014 and specializes in cognitive assessment. He has clinical and research interests in dementia, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, substance abuse, chronic pain, and general medical disorders associated with cognitive impairment. He was trained in neuropsychology and neuroimaging research at Dartmouth Medical Center in New Hampshire. He currently works for the Eastside Neuroscience Institute at Evergreen and Overlake Medical Centers. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our 4th episode on dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And Brad Tyson is here with me again. And this episode, we are going to talk about how dementia is treated and what are some of the things that we can do positively, proactively with dementia. And so let's go into that. And
yeah.
We've talked about a few of these things, but we can go into them a little.
Yeah, and again, sort of, we covered a little of this last time, but when we talk about treatment, we should talk about prevention, because, you know, unfortunately, as it stands now anyway, once you've been diagnosed with dementia, many neurons have degenerated, and it's often, you know, too late in the game. You don't want to be playing catch up, you know, with the brain disease. So the take-home message is really prevention. Dementia is not inevitable with age, so there's a lot of things that you can do to reduce your risk of dementia. And we talked a little bit about exercise last time. We'll talk a little bit more about that, or just touch it briefly. But, you know, really it's important to get your regular medical checkups, okay? So many medical conditions are associated with an increased risk of dementia, particularly if poorly treated, like high blood pressure and other cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, kidney disease, liver disease. So schedule regular medical checkups and treat any underlying conditions. Review your medications with your doctor, as we talked about last time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, your primary care doc can be your best ally in helping to manage any potential dementia risk factors at that level. We talked about exercise last time. You know, in particular, aerobic exercise is a...
And that gets your heartbeat going and gets
your heart rate going. And like we talked about last time, helps release chemicals in your brain that can help with plasticity of the brain, can help neurons grow. So, you know, designate a certain time each day for some light physical activity, even if it's just, you know, walking around the block, or schedule more intense workouts a few times per week. You know, frequent physical activity is extremely important. We also talked about learning last time. Staying mentally active is just as important as staying physically active. And the key really is, you know, a diversity of different things. Active learning, not passive learning. So things that challenge you, that are making you think hard. And have a wide range of these sort of thought-provoking activities. Reading, we talked about, puzzles, stimulating hobbies, learning an instrument, learning a new language. Again, even if you don't get good at these things, it's the process of learning that's so helpful.
How about a crossword puzzle or even a jigsaw puzzle?
Uh-huh. Yeah, but not in isolation, right?
Right.
Do those things as a part of a whole variety of different things that you're doing.
Okay. Right.
So if you're only doing crossword puzzles and you're only doing jigsaw puzzles, maybe it helps for a little bit. But once
in a dark room at your,
once these things become very overlearned and automatic, you don't get the same benefits. Mm-hmm. So really, you want to be pushing yourself but not stressing yourself out.
You know, looking a little bit ahead on the list of things that we were going to talk. Number six really struck me: stay socially active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because let's say if you do a jigsaw puzzle, mm-hmm. and you do it with two or three other people,
yeah,
you know, that would be positive. And also another thing that concerns me about this, or that I think about this, is as people get older,
mm-hmm.
or a spouse dies, you know, you're less socially active, and that can actually, you know, increase, I suppose, you know, not necessarily physically, but I mean, it involves depression. It involves a lot of these other things, mm-hmm. that you talk about that may have an effect.
Yeah. And we've known this for a long time. We've known that, you know, social activity is good for the nervous system. It's good for the immune system, particularly as you get older. You know, a study that is really sort of eye-opening here is a study, I think it was done in England, where they looked at the number of people who died in, you know, assisted living and nursing home care facilities between April 2019 and April 2020. And apart from all the people who passed away from COVID, there was a fourfold increase in the number of deaths between April 2020 and April 2019. And
that's fascinating.
It's likely that this had to do with the lockdown procedures and the social isolation and you know, these patients not being able to, you know, see and touch their loved ones and even, you know, other residents that they live with.
Yeah, that is, you know, you saw the pictures of people where the daughter would come and see the parent, mm-hmm. regularly, and would have to talk through a window at the retirement home,
right.
or those kinds of things. And as a personal kind of a story, about 10 years ago, I had a surgery on my hip, and I had to stay down. I had to be in this special bed that had sand flowing in it, mm-hmm. With no pressure and everything. And so after I was okay in the hospital, they sent me to a kind of a rehab facility, mm-hmm. in downtown Seattle. And I was, most of the patients in there, I was younger than most of them. I was fully cognitive, and a lot of the people in there had strokes or had issues with memory and just did not communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the hardest, you know, because I'm an only child, and I always had to go out to make friends. And that social part of it, for me, was really, really difficult. I mean, it was probably the worst 5 weeks of my life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, we know this, you know, quite well. You know, if a newborn baby who doesn't get touched as much, right, has, you know, can develop failure to thrive, you know. And when you get older, you get a lot less of that intimate touch and a lot more of the medical touch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to the doctor a lot. And that seems to have an effect. So there's so much to this. And like I said, we've known this for a long time, but you know, until probably more recently, we haven't known really what social relationships tend to be the most beneficial. And so there's been some fairly recent research on this, which is interesting and kind of amusing at the same time. So this study identified two main relationships that are good for the brain as you get older. One is intergenerational relationships. So relationships with people who are considerably older or younger, right? And we think this is probably because there's, you know, a lot of this reciprocal learning, right? So, you know, there's a mentor-mentee relationship very commonly in these sort of interactions. And then the one that's amusing is relationships with people in whom you constructively bicker. So the key word being constructive. So, you know, if it makes a sort of sense too, you know, if you're arguing with somebody, you better have a point, and you better have some, you know, some information to back up your point. And the process of arguing and debating, again, as long as it's not too stressful, is cognitively stimulating.
My wife and I bicker, but the problem is I'm always right.
Well,
and, that is interesting. And I've also, in my studies in special education and working with kids with behavior disorders, they did some study finding that kids that had an adult mentor or another adult that they work with other than their parents, that was, of the parents' age or older, they tended to do better because, you know, you don't always tell your parents everything, mm-hmm. but you may share more information, with another. So if they had another significant adult in their life, they tended to do better.
Yeah.
And that kind of, supports that type of thing. But bickering, yes. That's interesting. How you do it.
Yeah, and how you do it. I think
it has to be controlled. It can't be just a shouting match or.
Yeah. And sometimes you got to let your spouse win, I think. You know.
Yeah, well, I think that happens.
That might be part of it.
I am now the master vacuumer of the house.
Yeah.
So, I think that really is important. And a lot of times in the morning when I get up and I may be a little bit down, just having a discussion with my wife about politics or things going on in Israel or things going on in Seattle.
It's good to have someone to
reflect. It also gets your mind off of your own problems, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, another thing that I think is really important to mention here is eating healthy. So nutritional deficiencies can be associated with cognitive changes, particularly deficiencies of the B vitamins. So, you know, try to get your vitamins from your diets. You know, certainly antioxidants. We've looked at antioxidants as being something that you know, may be a treatment in the future for Parkinson's disease, for example. Use a multivitamin. I think there's pretty good evidence that a multivitamin, you know, certainly helps with cognition. And the Mediterranean diet has demonstrated benefits for cognition and brain health. And this is a pretty, you know, strongly supported theory at this point. But, you know, and it's based on the observation that people who live around the Mediterranean have a lower rate of dementia. And so, we studied this and we looked at all of the different factors, and there were many. But, you know, one of the biggest factors was the diet. And that diet includes, you know, fruits and leafy green vegetables, nuts and whole grains, fish and chicken instead of red meat, and cooking with olive oil. A lot of olive oil seems to be really helpful. And there's some speculation that olive oil may help, you know, break up amyloid plaque, which is one of the, you know, components of Alzheimer's disease.
So, you know, it's interesting, what you're really talking about is just a good varied diet, you know, stay away from the, you know, go with the Mediterranean diet, stay away from the pepperoni beef jerky diet.
Yeah. And there's a variation called the MIND diet too. A lot of foods in there to help with, you know, high blood pressure, for example. High blood pressure is a really sort of, you know, quick way to affect your brain substance, particularly if it's untreated for a long period of time.
Yeah. Interesting. This is a little off the subject, but, you know, you mentioned red meat. And I know that they've looked at, you know, for a long time, there was virtually no multiple sclerosis in Japan. And they had a diet at that time of primarily fish and vegetables and, you know, some chicken and some white meat. One of the areas that has the highest rate of multiple sclerosis was in Eastern Washington, where they had, and Spokane and Central Washington, where they had a very high intake of red meat. And I mean, you know, again, we're not saying that there's a direct nexus there, but I think that was interesting to, you know, what we start to see is just how what we take in affects our whole system.
Well, MS is really complicated. You know, it is something that is interestingly seen mainly in people of Northern European descent and women more than men. And the further away you get from the equator, the more of this, you know, disease you get, you know, so the higher rates of MS, the further away you get from the equator. So Washington is a hot spot, and, you know, places in Northern Europe are hot spots. So there's a lot of variables that go into MS, you know, so diet being one of them. But really sort of, you know, genetics and infections, exposure to infections early in life, that, you know, may stay dormant and then, you know, are re-expressed later and cause problems. So MS is a really interesting and difficult to understand disorder.
And if you look at countries that are close to the equator, and I did a little work on that, some of the countries, even in South America, where there's a lot of fruit, there's a, especially in areas that, like Peru, where they're very high and cold, that they eat a lot of root vegetables, and they had some of the longest longevity. Yes, so that's, and I also another question I have here that you talk about is, and this can be really tough. If you think that you are having some issues with Alzheimer's or dementia, improve your mood and reduce your stress.
Yeah.
Sometimes the disease itself can be stressful.
Yeah. Well, so there's an interesting, you know, relationship here. So depression and stress are among the most common causes of cognitive difficulties in older adults and can resemble different dementias. Well, also, different dementias can be associated with, you know, an increased risk of depression. So it's a bidirectional relationship. But, you know, even if you just have mild depression or stress, improving your mood and reducing your stress can help optimize your cognitive performance. And so if you're having more significant or prolonged difficulties, there are many treatment options available. I mean, counseling, medication, even brain stimulation therapies. And these can be very helpful for mood and in turn cognition.
Yeah, and of course we all know, like you mentioned down here, stop smoking and limit alcohol use.
Yeah, so smoking is associated with a staggering number of medical conditions, including some forms of dementia. And it's not nicotine that's the problem. Nicotine is not the culprit. It's anything that chronically reduces oxygen to the brain. And, you know, the part of the brain that's associated with short-term memory, the hippocampus, the part of the brain that's attacked by Alzheimer's disease, is really, really sensitive to stress and is really, really sensitive to lack of oxygen. So, you know, smoking, sleep apnea, lung diseases, you know, all, you know,
COPD.
Right. Affect brain substance and in turn cognition.
How about pulmonary fibrosis? Is that something that
anything right? That COVID, right? So COVID is a respiratory disease, and we see a lot of people in the hospital with hypoxia, right? So low oxygen to the brain, and these people are more likely to have cognitive symptoms in response to COVID and have the sort of longer-term symptoms associated with
COVID. I always check my oxygen with my little oxymeter, you know, mm-hmm. and so that helps. I mean, I like to do that. And I'd also like to see if I can't raise it up a couple percentages by breathing really deeply.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we should spend a little bit of time on alcohol, because alcohol is really just not good for the brain. And you know, there was some research out when I was in graduate school, looking at the Mediterranean diet in particular, and talking about how a glass of red wine was a part of this diet that's so good for the brain. And this led, some people to conclude that, well, alcohol is good for your brain, in moderation, in small amounts, right? But it turned out that's really probably not the case. The red wine is very high in antioxidants. And so the skin of the red grape is very high in antioxidants. So that was probably part of the benefit. But we know now, increasingly so, new research with large databases of people who've had, serial brain MRIs. We see that frequent or significant alcohol use, particularly later in life after 50, is associated with brain atrophy over time. And alcohol is really the only drug that has its own dementia associated with it. And so, it can reduce, certain vitamins, vitamin B1 in particular. People who drink, as their only source of nutrition, so someone who drinks a lot, can get these, vitamin deficiencies, malnutrition. And then, if you stop abruptly after you've been drinking a lot, and most people know this by now, you can have an alcohol withdrawal, and delirium tremens, as it's called. That is really destructive to the brain. So if you do drink a lot and you're thinking about cutting back, do it slowly, right? And talk with your doctor about that.
Yes. Yeah. Isn't it, who is it that said, I only have one drink a day, and I'm now having this drink for April 30th, 2017. So, and I would imagine that's also, how about things like epilepsy? Will seizures?
Yeah. So alcohol is a pretty potent cause of seizures. Not alcohol intoxication, because alcohol is a sedative, right? So it actually, probably raises your seizure threshold. But when it wears off, and alcohol wears off pretty quickly, so about one drink per hour.
About a tablespoon an hour or something like that.
So it's in that withdrawal period. So somebody has a few drinks and then they go to bed. Well, sometime in the middle of the night, that alcohol is wearing off, and then your seizure threshold comes down quite a bit. And so you're much more likely to generate a seizure in that, even if it's not significant withdrawal, each time you drink, you're going to have a little bit of that, a little bit of withdrawal. So yeah, that's something that people with epilepsy should avoid. And particularly since it interacts with the medications for epilepsy, which are also sedatives.
We certainly got the research that overall, and I'm sure somebody's like the Marlboro man has got somebody out there that's the McNaughton's man that has a fifth day or something.
Yeah.
But
overall,
to be avoided at least.
Particularly as you get older, right? If you're drinking a lot when you're older, you're coming to the hospital a lot probably too.
Yeah.
The other things I want to sort of mark off here that we talk about are good sleep. Okay. So practice good sleep hygiene. It's important for cognitive and emotional health. Everybody's different, but the typical guideline is, 6 to 8 hours of sleep per night. Helpful sleep hygiene techniques include maintaining a consistent sleep schedule with a regular time to go to bed and get up in the morning, using the bed for sleep and sex only. You don't want to do anything very arousing in bed other than sex. Don't, watch TV, listen to music, that sort of thing. don't have caffeine late in the day. You know, alcohol, you know, helps you get to sleep, but it doesn't help you stay asleep. Same sort of thing. Once it wears off, you have some wakefulness.
And I could, you know, I mean, not that I'm, that's a problem for me, but I can also, if I've, you know, had a tired day and I've had a drink or a beer or something, you know, the minute I get to bed, I tend to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wake up at 2 o'clock, and I'm normally in pretty deep sleep by that time.
Mm-hmm. You're experiencing that alcohol withdrawal. That's what that is.
Yeah. And I do drink a lot more, like tea, like a non-caffeinated mm-hmm. tea.
And I
like that. It's warm and it's a lot better for me than, I mean, I do like my coffee in the morning.
Yeah.
But
the other thing I would say that's really important to mention with sleep is if you snore, you tell your doctor and get tested for sleep apnea. If you snore really loud, if you have fatigue, if you have morning headaches, if you have cognitive difficulties, these are symptoms of sleep apnea. And again, you know, the issue is restricting your oxygen. Right. So not getting enough oxygen to the brain over time, you know, we sleep a third of our lives. Right. So if you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain at night over time, that can really affect your memory. Have your vision and have your hearing checked. OK, we have sizable chunks of brain tissue that are devoted to hearing and to vision. So, you know, if those parts of the brain are not getting stimulated, right, those cells die faster. And so these are things that can be, you know, fixed, right? These are things that can be treated. If you have hearing loss, get hearing aids. If you have cataracts, get it treated. Don't let these things go, you know, untreated for lengths of time.
Or glaucoma. I mean, you know, you can
exactly.
You know, certainly pressure. Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, the other thing that I would say, probably a little self-serving here, is, you know, get baseline neuropsychological testing. Okay, so that way you can have somebody who knows your history and can actually test your cognition, can test your attention, can test your memory, can test your language skills, and follow you over time. So that way you can determine, you know, with a pretty high degree of certainty, whether what you're experiencing, the memory difficulties, the attention difficulties, whatever it is, if what you're experiencing is just age-related, or if it's something, you know, that we need to be more concerned about.
Right.
So the things I really want to, you know, underline here are prevention and being proactive, okay? The earlier you can get something like this identified, the better your chances are.
Well, that wasn't too self-serving, and at least I won't... At least I won't close with saying, and Brad Tyson has 26 offices throughout the Pacific Northwest. So let's call it a wrap at that, and we will move on to our next episode. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Drive a Chevy 'cause he drove Chevys. Like him, I'm a baseball fan. I'm going back to see him while he still knows who I am.
This is Dr. Steve Nurse, and I want to thank everybody for listening to our series on dementia and Alzheimer's disease on Voice of Vashon, the Dynamo of Washington. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.
While he still knows who I am. This time I'm gonna hug him instead of just shaking hands.
tell him that I love him while he's still alive.